Have you ever loved someone so much that you followed them around and talked endlessly about them to all your friends and family? That's how much we love rhododendron, a quirky and amazing genus of flowering plants with a deep human history and an incredible ecological legacy. Follow along on our adventures as we learn about the remarkable things that folks all around the world have done for the love of rhododendron. Episode 7, Finding New Mountains. In this episode, we meet Steve Hoopman, Executive Director and Curator of the Rhododendron Species Foundation and Botanical Garden, located in Federal Way, Washington. We get a glimpse into the history of this stunning wild garden. We learn how observing rhododendron in nature provides insights into their cultivation. And we discover that consuming plant knowledge and finding new mountains is an actual career path. Much like John Muir described in a letter to his sister Sarah in 1873, "The mountains are calling and I must go, and I will work on while I can, studying incessantly." Hi, Roto fans, Juliana here. I'm excited to be back on the mic today, and I'm happy to have you here with me, so thanks for tuning in. I was really delighted to have the opportunity to interview today's guest, Steve Hoopman. He's somewhat of a legend in rhododendron world. He's explored many of the native habitats around the world where this genus occurs, and also for his leadership in creating a botanical garden that is truly a treasure from both an aesthetic perspective and a conservation perspective. So, what is the mission of the Rhododendron Species Foundation?
Well, I won't read it verbatim, but basically it's to promote rhododendron species, propagate, educate, conservation, distribute them to growers and collectors and other botanic gardens, to conserve them, to educate people about them, to display them, that sort of thing. A little bit of the history: the organization was started in 1964, basically as a group that came together to collect true species of rhododendron, because back then, when rhododendrons were very popular, there were no good sources for species rhododendrons. And so a group of collectors basically formed the foundation, the RSF, and decided, let's go to England and Europe and private collections in the US, if there were any, and collect verified true forms of species, the best forms. And so it was sort of a mechanism for collectors just to get their hands on the species, which were quite rare back then. And we've since morphed into being more about education and conservation, because a lot of the species are becoming critically endangered in the wild due to forest degradation, you know, all the normal bad guys. But we still do propagate and distribute plants to collectors and just interested people and other botanic gardens to try and conserve and spread out the genetics of the genus. So that's kind of what we do here. So
wonderful. It's one of the most important things you could be doing right now for rhododendron.
Yeah. So a lot of them are really critical right now. You know, a lot of species are basically just found on the top of one mountain surrounded by, you know, a few hundred miles of rice plantation. So, and that's good firewood. So,
right. Yeah. It does seem like it would burn fast. It's very hard.
It's always the first thing that's cut, because you can burn it green, you know, nice, hard, dense wood. So
interesting.
Yeah. Wow.
So, you mentioned there's the botanical garden, and what's that like, and how does it relate to the mission of the foundation specifically?
Well, again, I'll go back in history a little bit. When they first, the garden, well, it was sort of spread out among private collectors in Oregon back in the 60s until about the mid-1970s. And then in the mid-1970s, the collection had grown too large to be managed by the folks who were doing it at the time, who were also a lot older. And George Weyerhaeuser, his wife was on the board, if I remember correctly, or interested in species rhododendrons anyway. and Weyerhaeuser was building their international headquarters here in Federal Way, a big new complex with buildings and labs and all that. And he knew the RSF was looking for somewhere to house the collection. And so he generously donated 24 acres kind of back in the corner of the property. And they moved the entire collection up here from Oregon in the late 1970s. So for the first 10 years or so, it was basically a private club and wasn't really open to the public, except maybe one or two days a week during the spring. And as we continued to grow and continued to need more and more funding, then they started a membership program and a volunteer program. And we opened up basically year round to the public. And that's kind of how the garden became the garden. It was laid out geographically for a while, then taxonomically, and now it's more a sense of where the plants will do best and look best. So it's an aesthetic thing, but also where will the plants grow best. So it is a scientific collection, but we try to arrange it obviously to be pretty so that the public will want to come and see it. And we rely on a lot of that funding to keep the rest of our activities going. So for instance, we wouldn't plant Sino Grande, which is a somewhat tender big leaf species, right? Leaves like 2-3 feet long, down at the bottom of the hill where the frost collects. So taxonomically, that's where it should be. But if we plant them there on a really cold evening, you know, you can have 5 to 10 degrees temperature difference between the top of the hill and the bottom of the hill. So the Sino Grandes go up at the top of the hill. So that's what I mean by placing them according to their cultivation needs, because a big part of our job, obviously, is to keep the plants alive. So,
and that's a big job.
Yeah, because they're, as hopefully you all know, whoever's watching this, rhododendrons are quite varied. I mean, you have tropical species, literally from the tropics, and you have species that are alpine plants from the Himalayas, and you have species that grow on limestone, and you have species that are epiphytic, and you have species that grow in woodland, et cetera, et cetera. So trying to do all those in one Pacific Northwest coniferous forest could be somewhat of a challenge, although the climate here is about the best that we could hope for to grow the widest array of species, basically.
Yeah, and so I'm a scientist, and I appreciate the collection scientifically. I would say one of the most complete collections in the world. But then working there, it's also a delightful place to be. So you really have made that mix of like scientific value and the ability to like actually answer questions with the collection. But it's unique, and it feels otherworldly a lot of times when I'm working there. So I think that's a great combination.
Yeah, yeah. Most people are pretty happy with it. It's sort of it's sort of a wild garden, but it's still maintained. So you feel like you're walking through the mountains of the Himalayas or something with all these different rhododendrons growing around you and big 175-foot Doug firs overhead and magnolias and all that. So we try to do that, you know, to make it look like a garden, but at the same time to give the visitor the experience of kind of hiking through China sort of thing.
Yeah, well, and that's important because a lot of people think of rhododendrons sort of as your grandma's plant that's very formal, and your garden just blows that out of the water. It's like...
Yeah, I really do not like formality personally, so that's a big part of it.
All right, so we gave your official title, but I know that you wear a lot of hats there, and I don't think everybody's really familiar with what a botanical garden director might actually do. So can you tell us a little bit about what your role at the garden is?
I sign checks.
Very important.
Yeah. No, I have a really good crew here that takes care of a lot of things. And as executive director, which is not my, or was never my goal, really, I'm not a management person. I'm a plantsman, gardener. And I was hired on originally as curator, which I still am. The curator, of course, manages the collection and make sure it's taken care of and documented and all that perpetuated. And I kind of just grew into or fell into the executive director position in a sense. And you know, I just kind of oversee everything and make sure everything's going smoothly and answer to the board, basically, and then kind of just deal with the staff and the volunteers on a daily basis. In between trying to do the fun stuff like the curation part or going out in the garden and helping plant and, you know, cutting weeds and stuff like that. So yeah, it's, you could look at it as many hats, but it's basically, you could say that for everybody here because we're, you know, it's a 22-acre botanic garden with two acres of nursery. We produce 20 to 30,000 plants a year, rhododendrons and other plants, which we plant out in the garden or sell to the public or ship to other botanic gardens. And, you know, we're open to the public and we publish and journals and things. We have our own yearbook, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot going on here and there are 8 people on staff. So everybody here kind of just does whatever needs to be done at the moment in a sense. And it can seem kind of pell-mell and hectic and all that, but it actually works pretty well. So you have to have the right people in place to that, you know, are willing to just step in and do whatever and also know what needs to be done. Yeah. So I just try to manage that in a sense and basically fill in wherever the shortfalls are.
Right? So you got you're getting your hands dirty and looking at the big picture. So that's kind of cool.
If I didn't get to work in the garden and the nursery, I wouldn't do it really. You know, I don't want to sit in an office all day and deal with personnel issues and all that, you know.
This is one of my favorite quotes that I've heard in my journeys through rhododendron. One time you said to me, all rhododendrons are epiphytes. They just play at being on the ground. And that just fits with everything that we've learned in our research. Can you elaborate a little bit on that philosophy? Like, what are the observations that led you to that conclusion? And how does that perspective influence your approach to growing and or hunting for the plants?
Sure. No, that's a great question. So basically, as everybody knows, pretty much every rhododendron, some can take a little more sogginess at the roots than others, but most rhododendrons, most ericaceae, require excellent drainage, right? They need a lot of oxygen in the root system. So the best way to have excellent or perfect drainage is to be an epiphyte. The problem with being an epiphyte is you can dry out if you don't live in the right climate. For instance, you don't see a lot of epiphytes here in the Pac Northwest because we have we're a pseudo-Mediterranean climate and we're completely dry in the summer. So those plants just couldn't survive through the summer. And there are exceptions to that, of course. Whereas in the tropics or say in Western Yunnan on the Salween and in Burma, places like that, Southeastern Tibet, in monsoon climates, as it were, where most of the precipitation comes during the growing season. So then you can have a Sino Grande growing up in the top of a hemlock tree because it rains every day, or is it right. cloudy with swirling mist and all that. It doesn't really dry out. And it's the dry season actually is in the winter when the plants in theory are pretty dormant and it's cooler and they don't need as much moisture. So any plant really that requires excellent drainage, or the other factor, this gets very complicated, is if they're not that competitive. So that's one reason you find rhododendrons, other than in certain habitats where they're quite dominant, they're not necessarily competitive. So to get the light and to get away from the competition, maybe on the forest floor where there's rich soil, et cetera, the rhododendron can't necessarily compete with the blackberries and the maples and that sort of thing. Some can, and those tend to be, boy, this really opens things up. The ones that are competitive are the ones generally that we find much easier to grow in cultivation, like subsection Fortunia. Those are plants of the woodland. So they grow in soil and compete with oaks and maples and things. And when you bring that sort of thing into cultivation, they're much more adapted to growing in our gardens under oaks and maples in soil.
Right.
Whereas if you were to grow Camellia florum, which is an Eastern Himalayan thing, which is almost always, I've never seen that growing on the ground. It's always on the side of a boulder or on the side of a tree. Big hemlock or something. So it requires excellent drainage. So it has no competition there. It's just growing in moss on the side of a tree. If you were to just stick that in the soil underneath a big dug fir or oak or something, it wouldn't be very happy for very long anyway. So that's what I mean by them all being epiphytic. Basically, they just want good drainage and not a whole lot of competition.
Yeah.
So for instance, our Western red cedar, Thuja plicata, which is a common native tree here, has an incredibly dense, thick, almost impenetrable root mass. And it's also incredibly dense in terms of its foliage, so no light comes through. So if you were to stick a species rhodia or any rhodia, or pretty much any plant actually, underneath that big red cedar, they're not going to do very well. Not many plants are going to be able to compete with that giant tree.
Right.
And that massive root system. So if you could plant it up in the top of the, in a crotch at the top, and you had enough moisture through the growing season, that rhododendron would be fine, but it's not going to be happy underneath. Yeah.
It's really been fascinating to me, and it kind of opened up a different perspective on them. I'm here in Northeast Ohio where it's very wet, and I moved to a house that had a history of having a garden. And so of course I'm like, oh, rhodos, yay. But my rhodos weren't doing well. And I looked and my soil was all worm casings. And I thought, well, this is too rich.
Right.
And I actually had one that was, it was a Fortunii that was sick. And I chucked it on my compost in July. It was still alive 2 weeks ago. So I thought, well, I'll put it back in the bark and see what happens.
Sure. Yeah.
So it lived all summer, literally on a compost heap with no soil, and it actually improved. It got better. Whatever was ailing it.
You improved the drainage. Yeah. Right.
Because I think it helps you understand how to make them happy, because they really are a little bit difficult to make happy. So.
Yeah, they can be, right? If you don't have the drain. I mean, that's kind of a running joke here because, of course, a lot of people come into the garden and have questions. Oh, my rhododendron looks like this, or it's not happy, or it's not doing well. And we just say drainage.
Drainage, that's the answer.
That fixes it right there, yeah.
Well, I did want to ask you, what's the biggest challenge? You guys have this amazing team, one of the best probably rhodi teams in the world. What are the challenges that you face in your garden?
Well, currently, basically the changing climate. We're having these really hot, dry summers now and have been for the last quite a few years.
Yeah.
And it's impacted the plants in the garden somewhat. We're having to water a lot more, obviously, and that sort of thing. And we're getting burned sometimes, and plants are stressed. So now, for instance, we have lace bug, which has been moving north from California for a few decades now. But with these hotter, drier summers and more stress, that attracts the lace bug. If you look, we've actually gone out with a thermometer and measured the soil temps on a hot day, and you're looking at 110, 115 degrees for a little plant that, you know, grows at 14,000 feet in the Himalayas, and they don't like it.
Yeah, we don't seem to be able to keep rhododendron grown landicum or tomentosum alive here anymore, which was a native plant in Northeast Ohio. They die every summer. They just succumb to the heat stress, and there's not much you can do, really.
No, it's just what it is. So
yeah,
unfortunately. But yeah, it's the same thing. There are a lot of things that we used to grow easily, and you know, even Yakutia manum, which is heat tolerant, we just struggle to get it to go. And we used to have hundreds for sale every year, and now maybe a dozen. You know, it's sad.
Wow. Do you have a sense of some species or groups that you think are going to do better with climate change?
Well, again, the species that are more adaptable, the ones that are more competitive.
Yeah.
So some of the groups like the Trifloras and the Fortunia, Rubiginosum, species like that grow in the forest, basically, versus having to be above timberline or only in the top of a tree or on a cliff sort of thing, which is a very specific habitat. So it's a real tight niche versus I'm Fortunia, and I just grow as long as I have 3,000 feet elevation and some trees on a mountain, I can grow anywhere, sort of thing. So those species obviously are going to be able to deal with this better than some of the more delicate things that have a very specific habitat.
Right. That makes sense. You have traveled all over the world in search of rhododendron, and we want to hear a little bit about your experiences as a plant collector.
Okay.
So what are the regions of the world that you have visited?
Shortlist. In terms of collecting material for the collection, Asia, basically, all over Asia, and down into even Papua New Guinea for vireas. And for cultivated material, I've done a few trips to, say, the UK, like to go to Glendoic to get cuttings of things that they had that we didn't have, for example, which I might do again this year, actually, coming up, fill in a few gaps, and vice versa. But yeah, basically, as hopefully most of the people watching this know, most of the, probably 97% of all the rhododendron species occur in Asia. Or Southeastern Asia down into Papua New Guinea. So if you want to find rhododendrons growing in the wild, basically you go to Asia, China, the Himalayas, Vietnam, Japan, et cetera, et cetera.
How do you decide where to go on an individual trip? How do you set those priorities and determine your objective?
When I first started traveling to Asia to look for rhododendrons and other plants, I was pretty focused on the really intensely populated parts of the range of rhododendron, which would be like northwestern Yunnan, Sichuan, southeastern Tibet, where all that comes together is kind of the heartland of temperate rhododendron species. So for instance, an example I use quite often is on one day's hike in northwestern Yunnan, this would have been in 2000, we climbed from almost subtropical forest up to a 12,000 foot pass and over the other side. And we saw 39 species. So that's one day. Most of those in bloom. So you're looking at Sano Grande. And a few hours later, you're looking at Forestii, the little red creeping guy right up on top of the pass. So that's very satisfying. And you're covering a lot of territory pretty quickly. So I did that for quite a long time. Now I'm more focused on, as we were discussing at the beginning, you have these outlying mountains in parts of China and Vietnam even that are very isolated. So you'll have a 7,000 or 8,000 foot peak, let's say in southeastern China, far away from Tibet, Yunnan and all that, the Himalayas. But it might have 10 or 15 species of rhododendron on it. And those would be completely different from anything you'd see in Yunnan. And also, probably nobody's been to that mountain, at least not for a long time, from the West anyway, because... Right. If you're going to spend thousands of dollars to travel to China, you want to see 39 species in one day. You don't want to see 10 on the entire trip, right? So not many people want to do that, but that's my job, if you think about it. And so going back to your original question, how do I figure out where to go? You find new mountains in outlying regions like eastern China or southern China or central Vietnam or wherever that you can't find very much information about because nobody's been there. That's a good sign. Yep. But that hopefully has the altitude to have a temperate flora. So, and then you try to get permits and all that to go to that place and get the funding, et cetera, and go check it out. So that's cool. Kind of what I'm doing now is just trying to fill in those gaps in our knowledge. Basically, I'm really, really insatiably curious about how rhododendrons relate to each other and where they came from. For example, I did some research and also in the flora of China, if you look under subsection Taliensia, there's a species called rhododendron shanii, which, okay, that's one nobody knows about, blah, 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 which makes it interesting already, but it's found in, where is it found? Anhui. Sorry. I bet all day yesterday I was writing about another trip and I'm still in that province, but it's found in Anhui, which is way over on the east coast of China, right? So like you could take a train from Shanghai and be there in a half a day or a day, right? So right on the coast, basically. But it's a taliensia. And if you think of subsection taliensia, are pretty much all alpine plants from the Himalayas into Sichuan and Yunnan. So when you get above timberline, then you find Lactium and Pheochrysum and Proteoides and Boerbiae and all these famous foliage species, which tend to be rather difficult to grow. So when I saw that the Chinese had described a new species called Shanii from the east coast of China, and it's a taliensia, well, that's about as intriguing as it gets. So I did a trip specifically to go to that region, to that mountain, to try to find this plant. And we did, and it's a taliensia. It's remarkable. That's like somebody, you get a headline on the internet, ancient redwood grove found in valley in Virginia. You know, it's like that. It's like, how did that get there? And how did nobody ever find it until now? You know,
wow.
Redwoods are on the West Coast in California. You know, that's crazy. So stuff like that, I find very intriguing. And again, that's my job, to kind of sort this sort of thing out, which is a lot of fun, I'll have to admit. So anyway, long answer to your question, that's how I decide where to go. So I did a trip specifically to go to that region and check it out. And along the way, you find a lot of other interesting things as well, like Anhuayensi, which we refound again, which named after the province Anhui. So basically there's been one clone in cultivation since Wilson first collected it over 100 years ago. And it turns out it's quite common in Eastern China. And so we were able to observe quite a few different populations. And there's some variation in those populations even, which is even more interesting. So anyway.
Wow, that's so cool. You know, in science, the new graduate student thing to do is say, hey, nobody's ever done that. I should do it. And that's because it comes with a lot of challenges, right? Technically difficult is why people haven't done it a lot of the time. So I can imagine it's a fruitful avenue, but also
right.
it ramps up the difficulty of completing the task because
right.
nobody's been there. There isn't a mechanism already. You've got to make those connections and
right. I'm just trying to fill in those missing gaps, you know?
Yeah.
Because again, going back to it being a taliensia, what is it doing over on the East Coast?
Yeah.
Is it the original taliensia? And then they speciated out into all those new habitats as India slammed into Asia sort of thing? Or right. did it somehow migrate over to the East Coast from the far West? I have no idea, but I sure would like to know. But you have to first observe the plant and have some knowledge of it before you even can come close to figuring that out. And I'm sorry to tell people, I have no idea how that plant got there or why nobody knew about it until like 25 or 30 years ago, you know.
What's the most unusual or interesting thing you have done on a collecting trip for the love of rhododendron?
Boy, interesting. Yeah, it's all interesting. I mean, after doing this for almost 30 years, I feel like, in a sense, I know less now overall. Well, I know a lot more about the genus as a whole, but as we're filling in these weird gaps like Shanii and all these weird Fortunia that are being discovered, which we could get into at some point if you like, I'm a lot more confused about the genus as a whole, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does.
And how things are related to each other.
It's like you get a little bit of knowledge and you feel like, oh, I'm getting the handle on this. But the more you progress, you're like, oh, wait, it's bigger than I imagined.
Right. It's way more complex. You know, when the Edinburgh Revision came out back in the early 80s, it's like a good example is, oh, well, we know subsection Fortunia. There are, I don't remember the number, 28 species or whatever, you know, Dichorum Fortunii or Orbicularis Suchonensi. That sort of thing. Everybody knows those. They're well known, blah, blah, blah. I think we're up to probably 48, 50 species now with new ones being found still and how they're related and all that sort of thing. So, I mean, it's come a long way. But again, it's really thrown all of that knowledge sort of out the window because it made sense back then when we thought we had a grasp on it, but we didn't really have a grasp on it. And there are lots of little things in between.
while you are now quite a famous plantsman in rhododendron world, we want to know more about how you got started in rhododendron. So how did you first get interested in rhodos, and how did you end up at RSBG?
When I was at school at Purdue, I was always into northern and bog type habitats. So boreal stuff or sphagnum bogs, northwestern Indiana. The southern tip of Lake Michigan basically is where the study of ecology started.
Yeah.
And sphagnum bogs were a big part of that. And I just found that very interesting because we did have a few remnant sphagnum bogs from the Pleistocene still that you could visit and see things growing that you would otherwise have to go, you know, a couple hundred miles north to see, like remnant eastern white pine and eastern hemlock, Cypripedium macaulii and Clintonia borealis, really cool stuff like that, which are common farther north. But when you get down into the hot Midwest, you just don't see that material. And so I was very intrigued by that, and sphagnum bogs and ericaceae became kind of a special interest of mine. When I graduated from Purdue, then I was hired on as curator of a native plant botanical garden just outside of DC, where there was a lot of native ericaceae, because that's acid pine oak forest in that part of the world. And there were, you know, native kalmia and native rhododendrons and azaleas like Paraclymenoides and Viscosum and all that sort of thing. And Leucothoes and Lyonias and all those cool plants. And I just became even more intrigued with ericaceae, basically.
Yeah.
And I was there 5 or 6 years and eventually kind of followed a dream and ended up moving to Seattle, long story short. Actually, when we drove all the way across country and stopped at a little motel down in Auburn, right down the hill at the base of Highway 18. And if you know this area, Highway 18 comes right up out of the valley and goes right past the garden. And there was a sign, Rhododendron Species Botanical Garden, with an arrow pointing up the hill. And we were right at this motel, so we thought, let's go check it out. And it was early February, and I was with my girlfriend at the time. We came to visit the garden, and there were rhododendrons in bloom, and there were labels all through the garden with taxonomic information. And that's what I studied at university, is taxonomy. You know, subsection Fortunia, subsection Neriflora, and where it was native in China and all that sort of thing. And I remember just looking at my girlfriend and saying, this is where I want to work.
This is
perfect for me. It's ericaceae. They do taxonomy. Obviously, both of us were looking for a job, but about 3 months later, I had a call from the gardener here, and they interviewed me and hired me on as the gardener. And then about a year later, they made me curator. I was curator back east, and that's what I studied, basically. Anyway, so I was into ericaceae in general, and of course, a lot of ericaceae grow well out here because of the climate and the rhododendrons, obviously.
Yeah.
And once you kind of get into species rhododendrons, it really sucks you in. I mean, like I said, I'm more intrigued now than I ever have been. And I, you know, I've been doing this for 30 years, so.
That is very cool.
Yeah, so it just kind of worked out.
That's very cool. So do you have your own garden at home?
I do. I'm in West Seattle, which is kind of across the bay from the city. So it's kind of a little microclimate.
Okay. And
a lot drier and warmer than the garden, for example. But it can be 5 to 10 degrees less cold in really bad times there. So I grow a lot of Madania and big leaves. Like I have big, huge Sino Grandes and things like that. We've been in that place since the late 90s. So I have some of my plants that had a lot of time to mature. It's basically a miniature version of the RSBG.
Okay, here's a good question. What's something that surprised you during your career? And what advice do you have for others interested in curation and botanical gardens as a career?
Nothing surprises me anymore.
It's all surprises, right?
Yeah, it's all just day to day. Recommendations for other people, unless you're really passionate about it, do something else. and make a good living. You can do it for a hobby. But if you're really into it like I was and you can find a good spot, you know, it's very fulfilling. You know, I love coming to work. And I love what I do. That's a rare thing in a sense, especially in horticulture, maybe, to make a living and to enjoy your work. Maybe it's not such a rare thing. I don't know. But unless you're really into it, you know, get a job that pays well or marry well anyway. Yeah. And just study a lot. You know, I just consumed plant knowledge, from when I was a kid to till now. I mean, I don't work on it as much anymore. There's too much other stuff to do, but I was constantly reading plant books and studying and keying plants out in the wild. And doing that, you get ahead of your competition, basically. If you know more about plants than the other people, yeah, and you're a good hard worker, then you're going to be the person that gets the cool job.
Yeah, I was struck by your story that you were already deeply in love with plants, and you had spent a lot of time educating yourself. Yeah. And I'm sure, I know, as a person who hires young people, when I see a person like that, I'm just like, wow, I'm so excited to, you know, hire you, get you started. I think that's great advice, just to be self-taught, be self-educated, right, and make it your thing.
You have to put a lot of time into it. Yeah. If you want to kind of make yourself stand out a bit.
Yeah. You know, being at a botanical garden myself, we get a lot of students through and they say, oh, I want to work at a botanical garden. And we often feel scared when they say that. We're like, there's not that many jobs.
Right.
But they're great jobs because they are filled with people who care about what they're doing. And so, you know, I think it's admirable to try to put yourself in that place. And
yeah. So. And that's what we have here, basically. You know, nobody is here, or actually in any botanic garden, to become rich or anything. You know, they're here because they like what we're doing and they like what they get to do, you know, so they want to be here.
They care about it.
Right.
So I was going to ask you, if there was anything you could do instead of this, what would it be? But maybe the answer is.
Yeah, I don't know. probably live in an alley, I suppose.
Oh, no.
No, I'm kidding. Yeah.
They don't have very many rotos there.
I don't know. I've been doing this my entire adult life. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really. Clue. Yeah. So do you have any non-plant related hobbies?
My family, maybe that's an insult to say it's a hobby, but you know, families, and I don't mean that, sorry if that offended somebody, but, I do have kids and a wife and, do spend time with them, between that and work, you know, I do normal stuff. I read and we garden at home a lot and we like to travel, you know, all the normal stuff. I love to travel. So the last 2 years have been not that much fun because I haven't been able to travel like everybody else, but
for sure,
hopefully that'll change soon.
Yeah. What fun things are going on at the garden right now? What should people know to look out for and do?
Well, we're actually putting some new areas in and a couple of new paths, which if you know the garden really well, that will be interesting and a change because it will open up some areas that people didn't have access into prior to this. So for instance, last winter we completed a new path that links the back of the blue poppy meadow, which that used to be a dead end trail, all the way over to the pond. And now we're completing the other branch of that goes from the back of the blue poppy meadow through a lot of subsection Fortunia growing in kind of dense forests. So there are big, giant, huge glandulifrums and asteracnums and things, which again can take soil, and there's actually good soil there. So those plants are doing quite well. And the path kind of winds underneath these big giant old Fortunia and Griffithianum and stuff like that over to the big leaves. So that's been a real fun one.
Oh, that sounds exciting.
Yeah, you kind of hike through the woods, but it's all these big giant roadies. And so a lot of little things like that, that we're, you know, gardens are constantly being renovated and we're doing a lot of that right now. And we are putting out quite a few new species out in the garden, which are now, they're large enough, grown from seed collected in the wild, that are completely new to cultivation. So people will be able to see those plants and have a look at them and learn about them. Things like Guianianum and Brevinervi and Rivulari and all these really cool, the Shanii that I mentioned earlier, the weird Taliense from the East Coast, we're going to be planting out so people will be able to have a look at that. One question that I often get is, what is my favorite species?
Okay, I'm ready to go there. What's your favorite species?
Well, that's a good question. I wouldn't say I really have a favorite, but I will list a few that I definitely would not do without.
Okay.
That I would highly recommend, that I really like for various reasons. Like, so the big leaves, of course, I love, especially Sano Grande, because it does have the huge leaves.
Yeah.
Very attractive. Edgeworthii is another great one that I would definitely always have in my garden. Great,
great
foliage.
Plant. Yeah.
Beautiful flowers, fragrant. Lavinii actually is one of my new favorites. It's a little dwarf, kind of like this hardy Madenia with round leaves and big wide open funnel, not that big, but like this big.
Yeah.
And they're like porcelain white and fragrant, and it's been hardy outside. A beautiful little dwarf fellow. Rhabdodum, of course, with the white striped red flowers. If people look that up, Rhabdodum, that's a stunner. Platypodum is another new favorite of mine. It's a relatively recent introduction. It's endemic to the Jinfoshan in Chongqing, just one limestone mountain. It looks sort of like Euphengidzi or Orbiculari, big, thick, round, leathery leaves on a short, flattened petiole.
Ooh.
Just a stunning foliage plant. I'll send a picture of that.
I would love that, yeah.
And it's relative Euphengidzi, and there are several others, but those are all just kind of fun ones that I feature in my own private garden, let's say, yeah.
Nice. Well, that leads me to one more question. You have a pretty robust plant sale catalog. Can you tell us about your plant sale? Like, how can people outside of the Seattle area get connected with you?
That's a great question. So we do produce two catalogs per year. Wrapping up the spring one today, actually. And that will be put on our website probably in about a month or so. And people can order online, or you can print it out and mail it in or whatever. But we do, it's almost all of it is material that we've propagated from material in the garden.
Right.
So from cuttings or from seed, a lot of it's from wild collected seed. And a lot of these plants are things that you basically can't get anywhere else. So if people are interested, just keep an eye on our website. The new catalog, or the spring catalog, comes out November, December. And then the fall catalog, fall shipping, usually comes out in July. So we have two a year. And different things are in each catalog. And we sell a lot of not just species rhodies, but what we call companion plants. So magnolias, jasmeriads, other ericaceous things, cool trees. And we do sell some hybrids as well, some of the rare and hard to get hybrids.
Very cool.
Just to have those out there for people. So
to round
again,
it out.
And you don't have to be a member. You used to have to be a member, but anybody can order now and you can do it right on our website. So that's a great way to get some cool plants, and we'll ship them out to you.
Yeah. And I have to say, I'm just going to say that your plants, when I have ordered them, very good quality plants.
Oh, good. That's
I am always very pleased. And our gardeners have complimented, like, this is the best roto I've ever gotten. I think you guys really care for your plants that you're selling. And it makes a difference, because when I go to plant it, a healthier, happier plant is going to be more likely to live. So
well, that's great to hear. Good. I'll pass it along.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, I really want to thank you for chatting with me today. It has been really cool learning more about one of my favorite places in the world, to be honest. So
it was my pleasure to be here, Juliana. That was very interesting. Thank you.
You're welcome. And we will hope everyone visits this Species Botanical Garden and supports your mission.
That'd be great. Thank you. Yeah.
All right.
Look forward to seeing everybody out in the garden.
Yeah. Awesome. All right. Well, thank you, Steve. And thank you for listening. And we'll sign off. Bye.
We'll see y'all later.
Curious to learn more about the topics discussed in this episode? Visit our website at www.rhododendron.org. Here, you'll find tons of rhododendron resources, including tutorials, blogs, events, databases, and more. Click on the podcast link on the homepage to find more episodes, suggest a topic for a future episode, and get in-depth information about the people, places, and plants featured here. Until next time, keep carrying that torch for rhododendron. And don't forget to talk endlessly about this podcast to all your friends and family.